Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. I'm very pleased to have my former colleague and friend, Karen Sue Smith, joining us. Welcome, Karen.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, Karen has done some art reviewing for us, as some of our longtime readers know, and she's got an article in the current issue about a probably a little known, at least today, Swedish artist, Anders Zorn, whose work is at the National Academy right now. So maybe you can introduce Anders Zorn to us, Karen.
It's easy to introduce Anders Zorn for the simple reason that most people have never heard of him. And the title of this exhibition is Sweden's Master Painter. And so that gives away the fact that, well, maybe we never heard of him because he's Swedish. But in some ways, it's really a misnomer. Because while he is, in fact, a master painter, and he was, in fact, Swedish, he would be a master painter no matter what country he was from. And he made 7 trips to the United States during his heyday. He was very well known, so well known that it just seems almost freakish that we don't know him so well today. And we could maybe talk about why that is, but whether it should be or whether it shouldn't be, if you were to go to the exhibit and see his work, you'd see in a second how masterful he is and that he can stand up against almost any artist from anywhere.
Well, just to give some people a sense, he was, painting during the Gilded Age. He lived from 1860 to 1920. His style's been compared, as you know, to John Singer Sargent, somebody who's very well known now, but was not as well known, and Zorn was more popular than he was back in the day.
Yeah, I don't know how popular or how the popularity was exactly and over a long period of time, but they were pretty much contemporaries. They were, I think Sargent was 5 years older than Zorn. And Sargent had a lot more means, was from a family that lived in Europe and so on. And he himself was brought up in England and trained in France. Well, Anders Zorn was brought up as a peasant. He was kind of a hick, even in Sweden. And Sweden has not been known as the pinnacle of the art world much, and certainly wasn't at that time. But here was a man who was kind of like this penniless kid who learned to do art or wood carving from his grandfather. He was brought up by his grandparents. His mother worked in a brewery, and his father was the owner of the brewery, who then just kind of left the family right off. I don't think he ever saw Anders Zorn in his life. And this kid, it was obvious to all of the people around him, had an enormous gift for art. And he was sent off to school eventually, and in some ways, thanks to his father, because when his father died, he actually left the child a small inheritance, and his family had enough wherewithal, enough wisdom, really, to send the boy to art school. And he went to the Royal Academy. He was instantly recognized, I mean, in his first weeks there, as a star. And he never stopped being that, and he left kind of early. He didn't really, quote, graduate. And instead, he was like the leader of the youth anti-establishment movement. And he was so successful at that that later on, he had become such a raving success that when Sweden had an exhibition in the Chicago World's Fair, who did they ask to preside over that exhibition? Anders Zorn, the young, successful artist of the day.
Now, what kind of paintings was he known for? You mentioned in your article that he did some, he painted Grover Cleveland and William Howard Taft, and one of those portraits hangs in the White House. So he was known for portraits, but also natural scenes, correct?
Yes. Anders Zorn dabbled first in watercolor. He just, he wasn't supposed to be that. He went to art school to become a sculptor. But when he got into watercolor, it just seemed that he had a kind of natural talent for it. And so he became very masterful at that. And that was the first thing that he went out to do. And he had a reason for going to Europe and for going to more exotic places, which you will see in this exhibition. He went to Istanbul. Yeah, he has pictures of people in Spain. Spain was considered pretty exotic in those days. And these are some of the same places. He went to Italy, of course. And you'll see that a lot of his work will remind you of John Singer Sargent's, who did these same things. Many artists, even Maurice Prendergast, went to Italy and kind of became famous in the United States as a painter of Italian scenes. So this was something that people did. But Zorn had a particular reason for wanting to do this and wanting to become successful quickly. And so he painted scenes, exotic scenes at first, in watercolors primarily, that people would buy. and that he could make a name for himself because he wanted to marry a woman, a Jewish woman, back home in Sweden, who was part of the Swedish industrial nobility, so to speak. And her family wouldn't allow the marriage until he showed that he was able to support her in style and that he was going to be the kind of husband that they wanted for their daughter. And the daughter's name was Emma Lamb, and she is a very important figure in Zorn's story. We could talk about her later. But anyway, that was his reason for wanting to become an instant success. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. People saw these watercolors of exotic scenes, and then he also painted a few in oil, but he didn't get into oil until later. And it wasn't just portraits at first. It was portraits, landscapes, all kinds of other things at first. And then once he became more successful, he realized that he couldn't get the same kind of prices for his work. And you can't, generally, in watercolors, as you can get in oil. And so he did what all the other artists were doing, pretty much, was trying to do larger canvases in oil. And he had learned this in art school. He knew how to do oils, but he boned up on that. And he also learned to do etching, at which he was a master still. So he learned that after, I think maybe when he was around middle age, actually. So he learned a whole new art form later on. Then he did go into sculpture later on, too. So you'll see all of those things in the exhibition.
Yeah, you mentioned the etchings. That's kind of a nice surprise, something he was perhaps not as well known for. But you say it's a very lively art form for him.
One of the things that was surprising about it to me was his watercolors are very controlled, whereas a lot of people love Sargent because some of his style is the brushwork. Just it looks like he just slapped it on there, just slapped it over here, this color, that color, and the colors kind of explode. Zorn's aren't like that nearly as much. They're much more controlled. In fact, sometimes it's hard to tell his watercolors from his oils except for size. They are so beautifully done and masterfully done, you have to look at them with your nose almost up on the glass to see what it is.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. I mean, you think sometimes the stereotype of an artist is somebody who, you know, doesn't care about money, is just in it for the art. But he was somebody, as you describe, who was, you know, was out there to succeed and to make money and to be and he did. There's this picture we have in the issue. He almost looks like J.P. Morgan. He did very well for himself.
It's a great thing that you mentioned J.P. Morgan. But it's true. Zorn, in some ways, would have and should have appealed to Americans during this Gilded Age. And the reason why is because he's everything that you think an American is supposed to be. That was the time when America was coming of age, and some people were wildly successful. And we know the names of all those people who were wildly successful. And Zorn emulated them, became friends with them, and he was a very smart, savvy guy, and was from the very beginning. He would go to a place, even before anybody knew who he was, he would buy a beautiful suit. He was a wildly beautiful dresser. And there was a tailor, even when he was a student, who couldn't wait to get Zorn in there because he knew that all the other students would come running over and try to copy what Zorn was wearing because he set the trends, even in fashion. So he knew what to do. He got a studio in a very nice part of town, not just any place. And then he would begin to sell his things. Then he would go through Swedish aristocrats first. He would find the Swedish community because he still had a little bit of an accent, this hickish accent. It'd be kind of like maybe he had a southern accent in our country, or a West Virginia kind of accent or something like that. He was from Mora, which was a tiny little village. He wasn't from Stockholm. And he tried to get himself to speak differently, but he never quite could. And so his marriage to Emma Lamb helped that. But he went through all of her contacts and all of her friends. And then through that, he would meet other people. At this Chicago World's Fair, he met a hugely important contact. And that was Isabella Stewart Gardner. And she was the wife of some kind of industrialist. I forget what her husband actually did and where their wealth came from, but she became known as a patron of the arts. And she supported John Singer Sargent as well.
Now, one of the amazing things to me about living in New York and having access to all this artwork is that there exhibits like this seem to come all that, you know, that you have a discovery of somebody who you may not know, but has this rich body of work. And you are somebody who's an art lover and lives in New York. It must be a continuing revelation for you to discover these, you know, maybe these little known artists or a part of an artist's career that you didn't know so well. So it must be a very rich experience.
One thing that's really funny is I have had a kind of a favorite picture in the Met for a long time, and it was by Anders Zorn. And I could never quite remember who was the artist because I'd never heard of him. I can't remember exactly the name of the woman, but it is a portrait of a society person. And what I love about it is that it's not showy. And whereas I find a lot of John Singer Sargent's portraits so showy, and you can find Zorn's portraits the same way. I mean, some of his are that way too. This one isn't like that. It's a woman in her home, sitting there with her dog, and he has plenty of things like that, where the people look natural. They don't look affected. Oh, I wanted to say one other thing. This is slightly out of whack, but when you were saying that Zorn had painted the pictures of the presidents, this is one of my pieces of evidence that I wanted to put forward as why in his own day people would have known him or thought so highly of him, even in comparison with Sargent, which is just simply this, is why didn't Sargent paint those portraits? Why wasn't he commissioned to paint those portraits? And the reason must be that Zorn was the one that they wanted to paint them. And so the people, the powers that be, knew who Zorn was, and they commissioned him to do those portraits. And he even did one of those etchings of Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt was president in 1909. And so that was some of the time when Zorn was first getting his start. The other thing, though, about the exhibition is that he doesn't paint purely society people or their children. He paints Sweden. He loves Sweden. He even loves Mora, which is where they put the Zorn Museum, not in Stockholm. It's in Mora, his hometown. And you'll see some of the pictures by Zorn are considered Swedish national treasures right now. And he collected even Swedish buildings. There's something like 40-some-odd buildings that he has put on the property of his museum to show more or less the history of Swedish building and architecture. And there's all of these handcrafts, and they had a school. They were benefactors of all kinds of things in Mora. And so he did a lot of fantastic things, he and his wife did, with the money that he earned when he became fabulously successful.
Well, the other picture we have here in the issue is Summer Evening, 1894. And this gives you a sense of his presentation of Swedish life. You know, people obviously enjoying the warm weather, the break from the long winter, outside dancing. It's quite a charming picture.
There's a great story, and I think it's Rockefeller who goes to Zorn and says, I want you to paint my picture. And he says, oh, I'm sorry. He says, I can't. I have to go to Midsummer.
That's what I thought of.
And he says, don't you know who I am? And he says, oh, yes, I do. He says, but you don't know who I am. I have to go to Midsummer.
Midsummer, yeah.
I have to go to Midsummer.
You know, we can understand now that we've been through a long winter here in New York, how big of a deal that must have been. So you're an art lover. That for you, one can certainly understand why this is exciting. But for the average, perhaps New Yorker or somebody visiting New York, why visit an exhibit like this? What is it about his work, or just about artists like this that are sometimes worth going, out not just to the Met, but some of these smaller exhibit spaces to find out about some of these lesser known artists?
Well, there's a couple reasons. One, just the work is beautiful, and it is masterful, and most people will really, really enjoy it. There are still many people who don't take to abstract expressionism and don't understand modern art and that kind of thing. And those people in particular will just love this. But even for people who enjoy every kind of art, this is a setting the record straight. There's that element to it, that we do need to know who Zorn was, and we do need to put him into the picture. And the Met doesn't have a whole sets of artwork by him that fill up rooms the way it does with Sargent. And so in a certain sense, we think of the Met as the arbiter of what's the best. But you have to see this and use your own judgment here. And you can see why Sweden maybe has hogged up a lot of this, and he bequeathed a lot of the work that they still have, that they still own, to that museum. But it traveled first to San Francisco and then now, and it hasn't been seen in so long. That just to set the record straight is a second reason. But there's a third reason, and that is that this kind of artwork represents a certain point in time and tells you a little bit about what's going on, not just the artist in his life, and not just that artists at that time had to go out in Europe and compete and do portraiture to make a living, not just that, but that artists do reflect something. All art reflects something, and it reflects lots of somethings. It reflects sometimes the historical era. It's a way to visually see what happened, what people thought was important, not just style, but who they thought was important, who had control of art at the time. In other words, who could commission a work? How many public works did he do versus how many private portraits did he paint? You learn something about your own society by seeing it reflected in the work of an artist, like Zorn or Sargent or any artist. The other thing is a lot of artists make visible their own private utopias. There's an exhibition on Gauguin now, Gauguin's Metamorphosis. And as you, if you know anything about Gauguin, you know that Gauguin, like some of the Impressionists that were his peers, although he was not strictly an Impressionist, but they actually were a little bit disturbed by industrial progress and how the world was changing. And so they wanted to focus on something else. And so they had their own ideas of what's kind of an anti-present. They were against what was happening, and so they weren't showing it. They weren't showing it. And he had his own little private utopia that he was looking for, and when he didn't find it, he created it anyway, visually. And so that's another kind of way of looking at what's somebody's utopia, and what may be somebody else's dystopia, that kind of thing.
That exhibit is at the Modern Museum of Art, which is right around the block here, so that's another one worth going to. You also mentioned, to talk of maybe a few other exhibits here in New York, at the Guggenheim, one on Italian futurism. Is that a dystopian work like you were referring to?
No, but that's especially important, and that's just one stone's throw from this. So you could see both these exhibitions
from
the
Zorn
same
exhibit.
Day.
Right, yeah.
Yes, and to do so would really be an education, because Zorn is 1860 to 1920. The Italian futurists got started in 1909 and had a great turning point in 1920. So if you want to see how things change and how the changes affect the artist, there's not a better, more abrupt lesson in town. And you don't even have to be in town. You can see all this by just looking it up online, just looking at what the art museums have to show you on their websites. But the Italian Futurist was a real movement, and it became not worldwide, but it expanded beyond Italy. But the gist of it was that here are these young bucks, and it actually was young men at first. It was very virile-centered and machismo, in a way we would say, although it branched out later and had some women, some very important women as part of it. This movement was started by a particular person whose name I'm searching for here. Filippo Tommaso Marinetti is the person who actually started it. And there was almost like a big ad campaign to propagate it. And the gist was, we need a change. We're Italy, and we're new, and we're young, and we're virile, and we want the world to be the way we want it to be, and we want speed, and we want progress, and we want modernity, and we're all for high-rise cities, and we're for all the building of all these new things, and get out of our way kind of thing. And they would have these, they would stage these theatricals where they would try to drum up business, so to speak, and adherents, followers. They had poetry. It was kind of reminds you of the old Gertrude Stein poetry and some of those other movements that were started elsewhere, where people thought even literature should be different in the modern day. And this is what they wanted to do. And so they had their own words. They had their own manifesto of what they were about. They loved machines. And so you'll see machine type things in their art. They try to depict movement. They try to depict rapidity. They try to depict all kinds of area. They were the first, this is later on, but once there was an airplane and all, they try to depict aerial views of things. They have photography that shows aerial views. They like big, huge ocean liners. And Benedetta Marinetti, this Filippo's wife, did a series of huge murals that are in this exhibition. And very exciting. They remind you slightly of Georgia O'Keeffe, but of where she tries to depict speed and this whole focus on almost like outer space, water, She has a huge ocean liner that feels like, when you look at it, that the ocean liner is going to come right in your path. It's going to swallow you up in the wave. And it's slightly frightening because this coincides with the rise of Mussolini. And some of this fed right into Mussolini was a friend of Marinetti early on. And yet in 1920, they kind of part ways. And then you'll see, this is another very interesting thing about art, because there's a degenerate art exhibition at the Neue Gallery right now, too. But that is that as Mussolini became closer and closer with Germany, his ideas, which once were shaped by this kind of futurism, also it kind of coincided almost exactly with his views, his political views, and his philosophy of the new Rome and Rome rising kind of thing, Italian rising. That's not at all how the Germans felt about it. And they felt that modernity was somehow kind of Jewish and not to be tolerated, and was degenerate, more immoral even. And what they wanted was a kind of classicism, which was the very thing that the futurists rejected. So you can see these two forces going on in art. It's visible. It's like a visual representation of a clash of ideas. And then if you put that right next to this Zorn, we're just before this, with the rise of, it was the Gilded Age, the robber barons we later began to think of them as. All this reflects on our current state of history and our current state of affairs. All the talk about inequality, all the talk about how you can, buy a house in New York as long as there's lots of properties here, as long as they start at about $8 million. If anything below that, it's tough to find anything. That kind of thing. The state of art has a whole lot to say to people today about the state of their lives. And that's another reason, and perhaps the best reason, to go and see art.
Well, that's a great lesson there. And the riches, as I was discussing before, that the city has to offer. Guggenheim, some people may know, but here are two smaller galleries, the Neue Gallery and the National Academy, which have some wonderful exhibits and give you a real sense of what was going on 100 years ago, 150 years ago. So so that our listeners know, this exhibit at the National Academy, when does that go through?
I think it goes till the 18th of May, so you have to kind of hurry up. People in California already got to see it, but I really would recommend it. And sometimes I see people standing in that big long line to get in the Guggenheim, and I just want to tell them, you could see an entire exhibit over here in the time you're spending
waiting
in that line. And it's a beautiful mansion. It's housed in a beautiful mansion, and I also wanted to mention the Pearlstein, but I forgot that. I mentioned it in the article.
This is another exhibit that's at the National Academy, mostly nudes, correct?
It's just six paintings in one room,
okay.
But they're very huge paintings, monumental size paintings. Mm-hmm. They're all nudes, and they're over six decades, which is interesting because they all look like they could have been painted the same year. But what's so interesting about them is the different treatment of the nudes. We didn't talk about Zorn's nudes, but I mentioned it in the article. And the thing about Zorn's nudes, even though they created something of a sensation in his day, to tell you the honest truth, I talk about how beautiful and natural they are. And what's so different about them is that these are nudes of women in water, like going into a lake or something. They're not lascivious looking,
yeah,
or anything. And sometimes there was a little child, it looks like teaching your first child to swim, or maybe taking a bath or something like that.
Right.
And so here were these beautiful, beautiful women, much heavier than we would think of today. We like real thin women today, but these are voluptuous, beautiful Swedish women. And they're going into these natural settings. But at a time, in his day, people used to see announcements in the newspaper. There's another Zorn nude coming out, kind of thing. And they would rush to see what it was because they were so beautiful. Well, Pearlstein's nudes, you'll just see, are treated in a completely different way. And that is that he objectifies the human body in a certain sense, and he treats the body the exact same way he treats all the other objects. And all of these people are put together in poses that seem slightly unnatural or, posed, with an array of Americana, usually it's Americana objects, that he collects. And he treats them all the same way. He doesn't treat one as background and one as foreground. Henri Matisse had a famous picture that was something like this and accused of kind of burying the nude surrounded by plants and other objects, But this is a modern version of that. And it's very, very interesting to see it after you've seen Zorn's depiction of people and nudes in particular. Because you won't see a single celebrity. You won't know who any of these people are. It doesn't matter who they are. What you're seeing, in some ways, isn't any one individual. They're not even individualized. They're bodies. They're human bodies. And they're up against other things, a weather vane or a tricycle or a, you know, I can't even remember all the different objects. But it's such a different way of looking at people and humanity's role and place in the world of objects, that there's a kind of object lesson to be gained from it. Even if the artist, who's a living artist, Phil Perlstein, he's probably getting up there. He might even be 80 or something now. But I don't know what he's actually trying to teach or tell, but you can draw a lot of conclusions from comparing those two.
Well, that's a lot of fun. I mean, I do enjoy that about going to a big museum where you could take in two exhibits and kind of take in two moments of time or see what the connections are. So here's another case where you can do that. So, well, again, we'll recommend folks to go. And if not, we'll include links online so people can take a look at some of these beautiful pictures. So, Karen Sue Smith, nice to see you, and thanks for joining us.
I'm very happy to do this.